If you are listening to this podcast, there is a strong likelihood you love fine guitars and the people who create them and work on them. And if that is the case, you should know about the Artisan Guitar Show happening in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, April 12th through 14th, 2019. This is the ultimate experience for guitar and music lovers. There are concert performances. There are master classes. One lucky attendee is going to walk away with a Circle Strings 12-fret parlor guitars built by our friend Adam Buchwald. They have VIP packages, including concerts with Jimmy Webb and Brent Mason, who I am happy to say is going to be on this podcast in just a couple of weeks, and a lot more. You can go to artisanguitarshow.com to read up on it. I went over there. I was floored by how many familiar faces there were from the magazine, as well as folks who have been on this podcast, including Kinlaw Nelson, who I just interviewed last week. He's going to be there. Adam Miller, who was on this podcast, a month ago. Dana Bourgeois is going to be at the event, as well as Courtney Hartman and so many others. So go to artisanguitarshow.com to read up on it. I hope to see some of you there. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. Thank you so much for tuning in. I got to be honest with you guys, we have such an incredible lineup for our next month's worth of podcasts. If you haven't subscribed to the podcast yet, please do so over at iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review if you're feeling generous. And while you're over there, you may as well subscribe to our other two podcasts that we put out here at the Fretboard Journal, the Luthier on Luthier podcast hosted by Michael Bashkin, and the surprise runaway hit, The Truth About Vintage Amps with Skip Simmons, which I co-host. I had no idea that a podcast about amp questions would be so popular, but who knew? We're 7 episodes into it. No signs of slowing down. Keep getting emails from around the world on that podcast. So check that out, even if you don't think you care at all about vintage amplifiers. I can guarantee you will be amused and entertained, if nothing else. On this week's podcast, I am talking to our dear friend Mark Stutman of Folkway Music. Mark is featured prominently in the Fretboard Journal 44, which is going to be mailing in just a few weeks. We're just putting the finishing touches on that issue. In a story on neck resets, we have a piece on the evolution of the neck reset over the decades, how it's done today, how it used to be done, the whole Lundberg guitars, California neck reset thing, all of that good stuff. So it's a geeky story, but we love stories like that. And Mark added not only some great color commentary, but some incredible photography on that for that piece. So that's going to be coming out shortly. If you haven't subscribed to the Fretboard Journal magazine, you know the routine. Do so over at fretboardjournal.com. Use the discount code podcast. You will save $5 off your order, and we will make sure that you start with that issue. The window to subscribe and get that issue from us at no extra charge is shrinking rapidly. I think we got about a week left. So you're going to want to subscribe if you haven't yet. And that is a great way to support the podcast if you've been enjoying this podcast or any of the other podcasts that we turn out. It's been an incredibly busy week here. We have so many great podcast guests coming up. Steve Earle was just here yesterday, blew us away, performed a track off of his new Guy Clark tribute record, talked to us about his insane guitar collection, and a lot more. That's going to be showing up here in the next couple of weeks. We also have Sam Amidon on this podcast, as well as a video with him, and a lot more. It has been insanely busy around these parts. That's all the announcements I have for right now. Thank you, thank you, thank you for all the feedback. Thank you for telling your friends about this podcast. Please keep sharing it on social media and wherever you share things that you dig. And without further ado, here is my conversation with Mark Stutman of Folkway Music. Thanks for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast, Mark.
Hey there. How's it going?
It's good. It's been a while.
It's been too long.
Yeah. So you were on, what was it, episode 229 maybe, and I had to look that up. I don't have these all memorized.
I'm impressed. I was really impressed. Yeah.
And you gave us a lot to think about in terms of vintage Gibson repair and restoration. We talked about torrified woods. We talked about how the winter builds of Martin and Gibson sometimes hold up better than the summer builds. There's a whole lot of stuff to talk about. I know we just went to NAMM. It feels like it was just yesterday, but it was like a couple months ago. And I guess the big news there, among other things, was that Gibson has sort of made a comeback. They have a new leadership in place.
Right.
And did you get to go over to their booth?
Briefly. Their booth is mayhem. It's so busy over there. It's a little bit outside of my comfort zone in terms of busyness at the NAMM show. But I had a quick look at their stuff. They had some nice guitars, as they always do, and some stuff that I might have chosen to do differently. Overall, it's good to see them back at the show.
Yeah. I know a lot of folks have talked about their electrics that they had on display. I personally got more hands-on time with the electrics than I did any of their acoustic models. But
right.
I'm curious if Gibson hired you today and said, hey, we've got new management. We want to make our acoustics as good as possible. Do you have a laundry list of things you'd tell them to do?
Oh, man, I would have so much fun with that job. It would be great. I would really love that. Hey, I'd love that job at Martin too, but there's a laundry list of things that I would do for sure. I think it wouldn't be that hard to recreate some of the greatest Gibson models and make them kind of like what they were back in the day, and keep them at a price point that makes sense. You know, you don't need an L00 reproduction that costs more than an original 30s L00, I think. You know, same goes for a J45. If you can pick yourself up a great late 40s J45 for not too different a price than a new really fancy J45, I don't know, I'd maybe still just get the old one. So I think there are ways to make new guitars, new versions of great old guitars for money that doesn't need to break the bank for most people. There's a lot of new guitars out in the world that are really expensive. And, you know, if we are in an industry that some people are saying is declining and we are, you know, more kids are listening to music on their iPods than playing acoustic guitars, you know, well, we can change that by making guitars maybe more interested or more interesting to the people that might be playing them soon. So Gibson does that, like their modern J35 that they've been making is, I think, one of their best models of guitar, and it's one of their least expensive ones. Why? Because it's pretty darn simple, you know, J35, J45-esque kind of guitar. There's some things about it that aren't right. Well, there's a lot about it that's not right, but it comes closer than most anything else does. And with a few small tweaks, that could become an amazing, excellent guitar. So, among other things, yeah, there's a laundry list, but rather than listing it off, you know, maybe I'll just surprise you when they hire me and change it all.
All right. It was nice knowing you. Thanks for talking to us before you got famous. I mean, it is funny. It's kind of a philosophical thing, but, you know, we've talked about, and it's been written about so many times, how quirky the old Gibsons are. It is kind of a interesting question of, like, if they were to be standardized, even if they, you know, ticked all the boxes that you were going to say of all the improvements, would they still be as good and interesting as those weird old Gibsons that, you know, no two were ever really totally alike?
Well, so that's a tough one. I think old guitars are great because they're old guitars, and the effects of time on those guitars, and the material that they're using is different than what we've got today. You know, the wood that was used on guitars in the 30s and 40s sort of doesn't grow on trees anymore. And it hasn't, you know, we haven't had the 60 to 80 years worth of waiting time for that wood to really season up and dry out and sound the way it currently sounds. Torrefied wood gets you some of the way there. But time does more than just torrefy wood naturally. There's more to it than that. I think Gibson guitars can be amazing even if they're not quirky, and the quirks of the Gibson company are what keeps them endearing and interesting to us as repair people, but that doesn't define them their tone and their feel, you know? And I think that you can probably mass produce a guitar in today's market that comes pretty darn close. you have to be a bit more picky about the woods you use and how it's all put together. But I don't know. I think you can do it. I think it's doable. Sure. Why not?
Okay. It is funny because, I mean, there are so many, you know, just the nature of the beast, I guess. There are so many Marden clones out there, vintage Marden clones, that look and sound really, really good. And yeah. I guess because of lawsuits and financial and just customer demand, there aren't as many really well done reproductions of old Gibsons out there. And and it seems like a tougher nut to crack to me. I don't know why. It seems like whenever I see what looks like a new Gibson guitar, I'm like, yeah, it doesn't look like the old one. It doesn't have the same feel.
I agree with you on that. There are a few builders that are building amazing guitars that come pretty darn close to old Gibsons, definitely in terms of their looks and their feel. Each one is different in terms of their tone, and they are still new guitars. But yeah, I agree with you. I don't know what it is about a Gibson that makes them so hard to replicate effectively. I think a lot of the stuff that we love about Gibsons are their funk. You know, the things that are those idiosyncrasies and quirks that don't necessarily define Gibson in terms of their tone. Well, they kind of define Gibson in terms of how endearing they are.
Yeah.
You know, and how crooked that bridge is on the top, and how, you know, asymmetrical the body shape is, or you know, the quality of the tortoise shell, or what the pearl inlays look like. The electric guys are doing it pretty well. I mean, I know I have a friend who lives in town right near me who builds beautiful you know, Les Paul inspired guitars. And you know, Les Paul, he gets everything bang on. He gets all that quirk and funk, and he gets the you know, the bindings are looking just right, and the plastic looks just right, and the carve of the top looks just right, and the neck feel, and you know, even has pearloid manufactured that looks just right. But they cost a fortune, you know. They're not a fortune relative to what a real Sunburst Les Paul would cost, but they're expensive guitars, and yeah, they're expensive guitars, and I guess they can be expensive because the originals cost so much money. When you have a J45, like I said earlier, you can spend $6,000 to $8,000 on an amazing post-war J45, like the best out there. It's really hard to get that level of vintage accuracy and quirk in a guitar for less than that. It sort of doesn't pay to build that kind of thing, because you're not paying yourself enough by the hour. And certainly on a factory front, you can't get that close. But I don't know. Maybe my standards are just way too high. You know, I have been staring at vintage guitars for so long, and I sweat the small stuff so much on my repairs that my tolerances are just maybe way too high, or my expectations are way too high, or something. I don't know what. But I have yet to play a pre-war J guitar. We have a couple on order, but, you know, they're so hard to get. I haven't actually played one yet.
Oh, the pre-war guitar company.
Yeah, but the word is that their J's are as good at doing what they do as their Martin, you know, Martin-inspired guitars. So, who knows? Who knows? I'd love to. I actually have thought a lot about just building Gibson guitars. You know, based on the experience that I have working on them. But then again, man, holy, it's so labor intensive to do. It's just so incredibly labor intensive to do. I just can't imagine, like, why would you buy one for me when you can buy the original for less than I can sell you my recreation of it? It just doesn't make sense. The guitar I'd like to recreate would be an L00 or a J35 or a J45. And, you know, you can buy the best J35 in the world for, what, $10,000, $12,000, $14,000, $15,000? I don't know. The price varies all the time. But I couldn't make the J35 I wanted to make and not charge, I don't know, minimum $10,000, $12,000 for it. Just wouldn't happen. So I can't imagine why you'd bother doing it. I think that's also why Gibsons never were cloned, is that their guitars always have been affordable. You know, there's no reason to clone something that you can just buy the real deal of. The same way if you buy a Luthier-built Martin guitar, you know, you buy a pre-war D18. Well, it's only starting to make sense for people to build pre-war D18s now because pre-war D18s are finally worth enough money to do, you know. A lot of people can't spend $50,000 on a guitar, but they can buy a pre-war D18 knockoff for $10,000, and they're okay with that. Well, it wasn't too long ago that pre-war D18s were only $10,000 themselves, so people haven't been knocking them off. I don't know. The whole business is kind of like that, I guess. You know, the things that pay to get built, it pays to build, are the things where the originals are just worth way too much money. And Gibson's, there's not enough people that want Gibson J55s out in the world to bother making a J55 knockoff.
Sure.
So,
sure.
You know, J45s, well, you can still get a good J45. So
well,
who knows? Maybe Gibson themselves can do it, you know.
Yeah, I hope you make one.
One day.
It's your retirement plan.
Yeah, it could be my retirement plan. You know, I got a little ways yet to go. So I'll keep collecting prototypes.
There you go. So you mentioned pre-war as one company doing a noble job trying to replicate acoustic Gibsons. Who else is, you mentioned there were a couple others maybe.
Yeah, there's a few builders that are making Gibsons. I don't like waxing poetic about them because I haven't played them in person, and I don't know whose guitar sounds amazing and whose doesn't.
Sure.
I'm sequestered up here in Canada, and we don't see too many of these guitars up here built by people like Dale Fairbanks and Jackson Cunningham, are two that I can think of at the outset. Both of those guys are making incredibly beautiful looking guitars. Dale's been doing these aged basic, you know, Gibson replicas, J45s and SJs and L1s, and his work is obscenely beautiful. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine how much work it takes him to make those things look the way that they look. They're so beautiful and so well done and precisely done and accurately done, and they actually work and they play in tune. And everybody knows who plays these things that old Gibsons have a really hard time playing in tune because their scale lengths are so inaccurate. Their frets are all over the place, particularly the earlier ones, the 30s guitars. So it's nice to have a brand new Gibson that looks like a Gibson that plays in tune. They still don't say Gibson on the headstock, and I think there's so much fashion involved in this biz. We all want guitars that say Gibson on the headstock, if it's going to be a Gibson. And that's a really tough one for a luthier to overcome. You know, I really applaud those two guys in particular, Jackson and Dale, for making Gibson-y looking guitars that are very clearly going for that Gibson aesthetic and putting their own names on the headstock and doing it well. You know, it's fashion is such a big part of it all. We just, how do you put a Banner Gibson logo on a headstock without actually writing Gibson next to it? Seems like a bit of a thing, you know?
You have to come up with your own little catchy moniker, only as something else is good enough.
Yeah, exactly. And then try not to get sued in the process.
Yeah.
So far, I think people are safe on that front.
Yeah, yeah. You're always doing these sort of next level repairs. What's on your workbench right now that's keeping you up at night?
I don't have any crazy, rebuild a guitar from toothpicks kind of jobs on my bench right now, which I'm really happy about. The last few have really taken up all of my time and have made me be really behind in the repair shop. And it's kind of not fair to the other guys that work here for them to have to do all the, regular just set up and refret kind of work that still comes through the store every day. I'm working on, I have a pair of advanced jumbos that I'm working on. Last time we spoke, I had one advanced jumbo, but they've multiplied.
Oh, wow.
And the one advanced jumbo is here and it's all finished up and it turned out beautifully. It's nice to have in the shop. I've blueprinted it and measured it all up. And one day when I make guitars again, now I have an advanced jumbo blueprint that I can use. But there's a second one now that I've got that I'm working on. Who knew? So there, I think I've worked on, this got to be the only, well, there's one more advanced jumbo that I know of in Canada that I've worked on, belongs to a client of mine. I think that this must be the only other two that are in Canada. It's got to be. I mean, it's just so weird. Like, it's been I've been, you know, doing Gibson restoration work for over 20 years now, and in 20 years, I've seen only three of these things in person here in the store. I've seen a few elsewhere, you know, guitar shows and such, but I've not even heard tale of other advanced jumbos in this country. So it's really, it's a hoot to have both of those, two of them in the store at the same time. About 2 years after that last one was here.
Yeah. Do either of them have an interesting backstory of like a famous Canadian cowboy playing them or anything?
You know what? No, they don't.
Okay.
One has a backstory of being, you know, discovered by a family who just thought it was an old guitar. That was really cool. And they got the little fall back in awe Antiques Roadshow moment, you know, when they found out how much their guitar was worth. And the other belongs to a fellow who just plays guitar and has a really nice advanced jumbo to play. Lucky dude. But yeah, it's great. That the one that I just finished up is, you know, it's such a different thing. You really get, once you start playing these things, why people love this advanced jumbo model so much. It's a rosewood guitar. It's Indian rosewood, but solid Indian rosewood. And it's got a long scale neck on it. And it's such an interesting sound. It's so much like, it's so very Gibson-y. Like at root, at fundamental, it's so very Gibson-y. But it has that rosewood, note separation and clarity, and the power, extra power from that long scale, like medium strings with a long scale neck on a Gibson. It's a really cool sound. And they're loud, they're very present, very, very fundamentally focused, really amazing string balance from low to high. Like the treble strings are thick and meaty and powerful and strong, and the basses are still all that too. It's just, yeah, I mean, it's kind of like a 3-bar J35 might come a little close to that in terms of its raw power and fundamental sort of cleanliness and focus. But this is a two very scalloped tone bar guitar. AJ's are, the scallops are really deep. They're really trying to copy Martin's. The back braces on an AJ are, you know, styled very closely after those on a Martin dreadnought. And it's just so interesting to hear that with a Gibson, you know, with a Gibson body shape and a Gibson sort of top thicknessing sensibility and brace layout and a really wide X brace. And the top on the tops on them tend to be flatter than other Gibson models that I've seen. They're not as, you know, very obviously 15-inch radius tops and backs on these things. They seem to be much flatter as a Martin would have been. They really were trying. I think they were really trying to build a D28, and for whatever reason, they decided not to after a few years. But it's a really different sounding guitar. I wish that people could try them out and get to see. I'll have to find a J35 somewhere so that you can get a good AB video of an advanced jumbo versus J35, because they're just completely different animals. It's too bad that so few of them exist, because, you know, what people say about Gibson being thumpy and warm and mushy and these kind of things that are true of certain Gibson models, they're just not true of an advanced jumbo. It's really neat to have two of them. I can actually just say, well, no, they're both like this. It's not just an accident, you know.
And how far apart are these two guitars?
One's a 36, one's a 38. And they are both very similar in terms of their tone. The 36 is an early one, but it's built almost identically to that 38. There's not a heck of a lot of difference between them. The most surprising thing on an advanced jumbo is how the neck and string spacing is modern. In the mid late 30s, they Gibson had a 1 3/4 inch nut. They had a V neck. They had 2 3/8 string spread at the bridge. But the advanced jumbo has 1 11/16 nut. That's and a neck that's round and C shaped, and the 2 1/8 string spacing. Like, it's a modern space guitar that they were building before. You know, before they actually switched to modern spacing, you know, with the Banner models. So that's a really interesting thing, and I don't know really why they did that. This is a 1936 guitar. When Martin, in 1936, Martin had wide-spaced guitars. They were 1 3/4 and wide-spaced bridges as well. But Gibson in 36 decided to make this narrow spacing. It was interesting. Here's a quirky little Gibson deal. So on that 36 AJ, the bridge on the guitar, 36 was the first year for AJs, and the bridge on the guitar, I'm pretty sure just would have come off the line as a J35 bridge, but those were spaced at 2 3/8. So they plugged the holes in the bridge with rosewood, and they re-drilled them at 2 1/8, and the bridge has lacquer over. It's a lacquered over bridge, and there's original lacquer over all those plugs. But the whole thing was plugged so that they didn't have to make a whole new bridge for their advanced jumbo. And it was just like, well, there's Gibson in a nutshell, this plugged bridge. It's hysterical. Anyways, but it works, and, you know, don't fix what ain't broke, so it's still on the guitar, and just a neat thing. The 38 doesn't have that. The 38 bridge isn't original, so I couldn't guess what was on there originally, but the holes that are in the top seem to be spaced properly for 2 1/8 without any changes.
But on
neat
the
stuff, though.
On the older one, the plugs have held up, like, through all these years?
Yeah, the low E plug fell out.
Okay.
Because it was small, but it didn't matter. The bridge plate, the plugs were done before the bridge was glued on the guitar, so the holes in the bridge plate and the top are perfectly fine. So if the bridge pin is a little loose at the top because there's a slightly wider hole there, whatever. Who cares? The world's going to go on. So I just left it. I figured it was best to leave original Len to mess with. There really wasn't any problem with it the way it was, you know. And the other five holes have held up just fine. That guitar has its original saddle in it too, and original frets. Like the whole thing is dead stock original. So it's a bit of a time capsule. It's really neat to get a chance to get your hands on one of those things that hasn't been all messed up or changed or repaired, you know, over the years. You can really get a feel for what Gibson was going for with it. The flatter top is the most interesting thing about it. You'd expect to see the 15-inch radius as Gibson put on most of their guitars at the time, and this really doesn't have that radius to it. You know, there's some pull behind the bridge, as there always is, but if you measure the top radius at the arms of the X-brace, which is the best place to do it because Gibson braces were radiused, like the underside of the brace was radiused. So that part of the top, even if there's deformation over the years, that radius in the X-brace is still largely there. This doesn't have radius on the X. Like it's like got a 35 or 40-foot radius, like something that you might find on a Martin. It's super interesting. And that's one, you know, that's the sort of thing that you only sort of discover once you see these things in person. You know, that's not written about in Daniel Lewine's fabulous flat-top book. Or maybe it is. I don't recall. It's been a while since I read that book, but I don't think it is. I didn't remember that about those guitars. I have to go do some background research and do some reference checks. But, yeah, that was an interesting thing. There's no question about that.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah. Your Gibson geekery for the afternoon.
All right. And then what else are you working on?
What else am I working on? Well, I just got back from a week off, so I'm currently not working on anything except for the pile of stuff that came in that I have to go look at. But the regular assortment of interesting small body Gibsons and, you know, L00s and L1s. And I've got a really interesting 13-fret L00 in the store right now that is getting its neck reset. As far as I understand, they only made one batch of these 13-fret black and white L00s, and I've never actually seen one in person. There's a wonderful man who posts from time to time on Facebook, and, you know, the Gibson group Facebook page, Terry, who has kept meticulous records about Gibsons over the years, and we're constantly sharing interesting, you know, Gibson finds across email and Facebook messages. And I told him about this 13-fret Gibson L, and he was like, oh, yeah, I've had three of those. You know, they only made them in this one batch. And it was really great. He's you know, he's been doing this for, I guess, I don't know, 20 or 30 years longer than me, and seen everything in the world, and there's nothing new to that guy. But it was neat. It was it's neat to, you know, have some confirmation about a guitar based on its factory order number and how it's made. But that's a cool guitar. So 13 fret, L00. And then of course there's a few neat Martins on the bench. There always are. There, you know, a customer just brought in a super super clean red spruce topped 1953 00021, which is a gorgeous guitar. Those red spruce, well, I call them red spruce, and I'll continue to call them. There's still discussion as if they're Engelmann or something else, but I really think they're red spruce. Those 53s are they're incredible guitars. It's amazing how much of a sound difference, a tone difference, you get from a red spruce top 53 than a Sitka spruce top 53. They're night and day guitars, and yeah, it just shows off what that tone would bring us to a guitar. There's nothing like red spruce on a guitar. There just isn't. And all the hoopla, I think, is well-founded. Just based on that one data point of 1953 Martins that have red spruce versus 54 Martins that don't. The 53s are incredible instruments. And this 00021, same deal. So it's here for a neck reset. I'm excited to get that done and get it finished. There's a ton of neck reset work in the shop right now, and that's good. I like doing neck resets, and the actual restoration work side of my job is a little bit on the light side right now, which is really, really lovely. I have a few that are, you know, store stock guitars like that need the serious amount of love, but we're going to try to push through a bunch of these neck resets first and try to get a few less guitar cases in the building. It's sure. Getting a little out of control.
Speaking of neck resets, we have a story in the Fretboard Journal 44 on neck resets, which you graciously provided photos for and also were interviewed in. Thank you for that. How long does it take you to do a typical 50s Martin neck reset?
I wish I could answer that question for you. It can go pretty quickly sometimes, and it can go really slowly other times. The neck removal process, if all goes well, start to finish is 45 minutes if all goes well. And that's, you know, me taking the tuners off of the guitar and bridge pins and taking out the fret and doing all the preparatory sort of stuff. And then the actual neck removal part, that's if it all goes well. But Martin's generally it's seldom on a guitar that's never been worked on before. It's seldom that I have problems taking a Martin neck apart cleanly, because they're so predictably made. Every now and then you encounter something that gives you a bit more of a challenge, but it's never really a big challenge. Grain orientation of the top always poses a problem when you're taking a neck off, and being able to pull that fingerboard extension off without doing any top damage is critical, and grain orientation is the tricky thing. It's always way more work to take a Gibson neck off, or almost always more work because of those funky idiosyncrasies of Gibson. But Martins are pretty straightforward. On a Gibson, like on the Advanced Jumbo that I just finished up, I think I let that neck removal process take 4 hours.
Wow.
On another Gibson, like on a guitar where that is a top over dovetail kind of guitar, or is a Gibson that has a shim under the fingerboard from the factory, you know, and if it's a really clean, valuable, you know, say Gold Sparkle L2, it could take me all day to take that neck off. And it's just only because I'm going super slowly and methodically to make sure that I get this thing apart perfectly cleanly. You want to, it's a controlled thing, the taking necks off. It's not like a Wild West where you just like throw a bunch of steam at it and hit the thing with a hammer. You have to go slowly, and you have to be watching and listening and be very aware and stuff. So That's part A. So, you know, let's say it's a 50s Martin with high glue and it's, you know what you're getting into and the grain run out isn't terrible. Yeah, 45 minutes to take a neck off, that's pretty much my norm. I know some people who can do it way faster than that and some who take longer, but we're all different. As long as it gets off cleanly, it doesn't matter. You just make sure it happens properly and not too much steam and not too much. You want to not have finish damage, obviously. And then putting it, me, I like to let the guitar sit for at least a month to dry out before I start working on them again. You can do a neck reset, 3 days later. I have done that when I've had to, but really, in my books, the better dried out a neck is, the more predictable my results are going to be. I don't want to do a whole neck reset and then the whole thing changes or the heel opens at the bottom because the neck was maybe a little bit too wet when it was refit. So I let them sit for a month or so. And then once I'm working on it again, the fitting of the guitar, that generally takes half a day, but in fits and starts, I do a bunch of fitting and then fitting up the actual heel to the body, and then I'll glue shims on to fill out the dovetail, and then I'll do some more fitting and then fit those shims, fit the actual dovetail joint so that the contact is really nice, and you got to wait for that glue to dry on the shims and all that. And sometimes sometimes it goes really easily and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you do all this neck work and then you're checking with a straight line, with a fishing line to see your left right alignment, and you discover, oh man, I'm a little bit over to this one side, and you have to sort of refit a little bit, and that happens. And the most important thing is that you get the footprint over where the footprint used to be, and you don't go changing. I don't want to be doing finish touch up on a neck reset. I want it to look like I was never there. So the tricky ones are when you're working on a guitar where the bridge was glued on in the wrong place from the factory, either too far left or too far right, and you've got your E-strings are either positioned too far to the bass side of the guitar or too far to the treble side of the guitar, and you want to fix that in the neck reset, but you also don't want to do finish touch-up. Those are the ones that can take a long time to do. And then, man, any guitar can take a long time, just because it, just because it woke up on the wrong side of the bed or something. Yeah. But the neck reset thing is a hard one for us. I've only recently really started timing myself on these jobs because it's hard to charge. It's hard to charge for something that has a variable amount of time. It's not like, you've got a Ford F-150 and you need new brakes, and there's a book price for what brakes are worth at the dealership on a Ford F-150. It doesn't work that way with guitars. And to say my neck reset is $500 or my neck reset is $800 or whatever that number is going to be, it doesn't work. If you want to pay yourself fairly, you have to track the time and then just attach an hourly figure to it. And so that's what I've been trying to do lately, but I don't know. It's still really hard because somebody comes in with some 50s, like let's say they have a 50s 015. You can't say, well, I don't know what this neck reset is worth. It could be $500 or it could be $1,000. Nobody wants that when they want to drop off a guitar. So it's a tricky one. It's definitely a tricky one. And I don't actually know how long a neck reset takes. Long and short, after all that verbal diarrhea, I have no idea how long it takes.
How off have you been on your original estimate?
Oh, man, I've been so off. Okay. I have been so off. Oh, my God. You don't even want to go down that road. This is why I'm trying to keep track of things here, is that it's incredible that you get really off on a guitar that that has issues that you didn't know about, because you can't see what's going on until you get under, until you take the thing apart, particularly in my world with Gibsons, you never know what's going on underneath the hood, and there are so frequently surprises that you can't that you can't account for. With Martins, there's not usually surprises unless somebody's come and done the job for you first, and you're redoing someone else's work. That's when you can really lose your shirt on a repair, and maybe you didn't know that somebody used epoxy, or somebody don't know, did some other silliness that you just weren't aware of. You know, or somebody, there was an old repaired heel crack that somebody, you know, repaired and then did a really nice finish touch up to, and you didn't really notice it before you started, but you certainly noticed it once you got steam involved. There's all kinds of things. So people that bring guitars in that have other people's old repair work, those are the grain of salt ones, big time, that I just don't put an estimate on. And I know a lot of repair guys who don't do estimating. They're like, you want me to do this job, I'm going to do this job, and whatever it costs is what it costs, and I need you to be okay with that. There's plenty of repair guys that operate that way. And I think that's great. I wish I could do the same. It's harder in the environment of my shop. We have a lot of people just walking off the street that need guitar repair, and they're not coming specifically because we're Folkway Music. They're coming just because we're the local shop that does that stuff, and they need to get a hard and fast price, and they're going to compare our price to whoever it is down the road who might also do work on guitars. So, you know, we still have to do estimating as much as it causes some grief to me in the long term.
Sure. I gotta be honest. I know this is kind of a dumb question, but it seems like when we look on Instagram, certainly when we look in the forthcoming Fretboard Journal article, like all the glory shots are of the steam pulling the neck off of the body, you know,
yeah.
The original, the right. Gory, you know, whatever. I can't even wrap my head around what you must do after that neck's off and after it's rested to get the alignment on. You're dealing with a guitar that's not under tension yet and trying to foresee what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Is this just with experience you figure this stuff out?
I think that there are two kinds of people. There are the people that are very analytical and measurement focused about it. And I know lots of people who have various, you know, angle measuring devices that they use to get left and right and forward back angles dialed in on a guitar. I do it all by eye and by feel. And that just works for me. And I've done enough of them that I can, when I'm fitting the neck and I have a way of holding it, that I can sort of flex the whole thing and see how the body's going to deform under string tension. And 95% of the time, what I thought would happen happens. Every now and then it doesn't. And yes, I have, in fact, redone neck resets that I finished. I've taken necks off and put them back on again if I miss something. Some people string their guitars up with no glue in the neck joint, just to see what it's going to do under tension. And that's kind of risky. It can work. I've done it. And to be honest with you, I did that on a guitar and recently, and I was really happy I did it because I had a suspicion that my angle wasn't right, even despite experience and thinking, you know, and setting it to where I had set it to. I had a sneaky sort of suspicion that this guitar wasn't going to be cooperative, and when I glue it up, I'm going to get an underset neck. And so I did it. I shimmed that neck out and I strung this thing up with no string tension on it. I mean, with no glue in the glue joint. I put full string tension on it, and I watched as the guitar sort of bent as I was worried that it might, and lo and behold, I had an underset neck, and so I was able to pop it off and fit the neck better, more accurately. But, you know, I think you just got to be careful, and certainly experience is a huge help. Oftentimes, if you are resetting a neck, you've got the footprint of where the neck used to be, and if you've measured the guitar before you took the strings off, you know that that footprint is right. And if your fingerboard extension lines up with the fingerboard extension footprint that you've got, chances are good you've got your left-right alignment pretty good. But you should always check with a string. I just have some fishing line at the bench, and I just kind of hold it up from the nut slot to the bridge pin, and I check both sides. And if it looks right, then it's got to be right. You can mess up a neck fitting it. The biggest way that you can mess up a neck reset, though, is taking the neck off badly. And that's why the glory shots are always with the steam and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Like, for any of us that do the work, the trophy in a neck reset is more so the removal cleanliness than the finished product. Because once you get the neck off cleanly, you know, you just have to be precise and you know, careful to check your work before you glue it back on to get a neck reset right. The actual reattachment of the neck, you know, if you are a craftsman with some basic skills, shouldn't be that hard. It really shouldn't be. Don't use cardboard in shims, because the cardboard has really poor shear qualities, and neck joints tend to fall apart when you have cardboard shims in there. But apart from that one golden rule of actually using wooden shims that are glued in properly, and just being careful, the reassembly is fairly routine, regular work that you just have to take your time and do well. It's the taking it apart that's where you can completely and totally destroy a guitar. And so that's why you see all these glory shots of people with their steam and taking their guitar apart. And that's the biggie for sure. And there's been some great, there's been a lot of sharing about ways to take guitar necks off well. You know, like Frank Ford started the whole thing off by showing the world. He has this cool way of directing air from his compressor at the little places where steam might like to get out that and hurt the finish. So, you know, a lot of us have built these ornate sort of jigs that blow steam, blow cold air on the guitar as we're steaming it to direct the steam away from the guitar. And I built something like that, and it's wonderful. And then Stu Mac has their jig where their sort of jig that pushes necks out of guitars. And years ago, I built my copy of that jig, and I still use the exact jig that I built 20 years ago. It works perfectly. The Stu Mac one is great. 20 years ago, I just didn't feel like spending the money on a Stu Mac jig. So I built one, and it's a really good tool with some extra modifications that I've made to it. But I think the biggest single thing about getting guitars off cleanly is just to have done it before, particularly with Gibsons. You know, like, you just need to know what to expect. You need to know what it feels like and sounds like and looks like when things are going right and when they're going wrong, and be able to maintain control of the whole process. I think it's just like a surgery, you know, of any kind. You just have to maintain your control. And as long as you do, you'll get it off well.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to read that neck reset article. When is that coming out? It's in 44?
Yeah, it's in 44. It'll be out in April.
Cool. That's neat. That's soon. That's great.
So when you do, you mentioned the shims, don't use cardboard. Do you use the same shims regardless of who made the guitar, if it's a Martin or Gibson or something else?
Well, I generally use mahogany shims on mahogany guitars.
Okay.
On mahogany necks. And, like, I'll match the neck wood.
Okay.
You know? So if it's a maple, if it's for some bizarre reason you're pulling a maple neck guitar out, like a Banner J45 or something, then I'll use maple on those shims. I don't think it actually makes any difference, to be honest with you. I think wood of any kind is good, and mahogany is easy to carve, easier than maple, so it's nice to use. But yeah, as long as it's not cardboard and as long as it's not little dots of shims. I've seen some I've taken apart that the actual shim that's used is just like a fingernail size shim that's stuck on, you know, to the bottom or like to the four sort of corners of the dovetail. And the rest of the glue surface area of that dovetail is totally ignored. And to me, that doesn't make sense at all. So I like shimming out, and I think most people like shimming out their dovetails with wood and then fitting it to be a well-fitting joint. And most people use chalk they sort of chalk the male part of the dovetail or the female part of the dovetail, and then you put the neck in there, and then the chalk will register on the other surface, and you'll know which is the high point that you have to remove. And it's hard to fit a blind joint. That's sort of just a standard woodworker thing to do in fitting a blind joint, is just to chalk it so you can see what's going on. But as long as you do that, you know, another thing that I do all the time is I just, when I'm doing my final fit, I just make sure that if the dovetail is going to be microscopically tighter at the top or the bottom, I make sure that it's going to be that little teeny bit tighter at the bottom, meaning further from the fingerboard, because that just needs, we don't want it to open, right? So to fit the whole neck and make sure that the fit stays nice and snug, I always have this slightest micron of extra tightness at the heel, at the end of the heel. And that just makes things stay together well, you know. Beyond that, I don't know, just glue it all back together and just call it done.
Easy for you to say.
It's yeah, I guess I've done a few of them by now. It's neat, though. I have to say, sorry, I'm babbling here, but I love seeing how other people do stuff. I think as guitar repair people, we so often just exist in our own little universe, and we develop our own, you know, our repair techniques evolve through our careers, and we develop our ways of doing things. And sometimes some repair people that I've come to meet over time have evolved their repair, you know, style, their technique identically to mine. It's like this co-evolution thing that happened, you know, where we both do the same job, and we've gotten to the same way of doing things completely on our own because it just made sense. Whereas some other people, they're process is completely different than my process, and their end results are still beautiful. And it's really eye-opening to see how different we all can do things and still maintain a quality of work that is universal, which is great. I've learned a lot about other people's repairs just by following repair guys on Instagram. You know, there's such a community of sharing now on social media. You know, there's even some people that show their flaws on Instagram, which I haven't yet been able to do. But some people have the strength of character to do that, and it's amazing. It's amazing when someone says, "Hey, guys, everyone else doing this job, don't do this because it didn't work for me, and here's why." And so we're definitely in a golden age of repair, and there's so many more skilled repair people. Well, and builders, but we're talking about repair. So skilled repair people out there now than there have ever been before, which is fabulous. So, you know, we'll have less and less scary Frankenstein repairs coming through the store in years going forward.
Is there a specific hashtag for the mistakes people have made that we can all search right now and just get all of them
in one
column?
I don't know what that hashtag is. We got to find it. I just look for guitar repair hashtags or luthier hashtags, neck reset hashtags. But I don't know what the guitar Frankenstein hashtags should be or the blooper hashtags. Maybe we should create one, Jason. Right now,
you've got the Instagram following. You figure it out, and I will promote it.
All right, I'm gonna work on that when we get off the telephone. That means I'd have to show a mistake or two every now and then. I don't like doing that. I'm not good at that.
Yeah.
They happen, I promise you. Everyone makes mistakes. It's ignorant to think that people don't make mistakes, that the best in the world make mistakes and learn from them and move on. You know, I starting off in this job, made a ton of mistakes, but thankfully I was making mistakes on guitars that I owned that didn't belong to other people. And so, you know, it was a much, much better way to learn than making mistakes on other people's guitars.
Maybe whenever the next Asia Symposium is, that can be the big topic, is what's the blooper hashtag going to be?
Yeah, we should do that. I haven't been to an Asia Symposium in many, many years, but maybe this is the reason to go back. Another reason to go to Nashville or wherever they happen.
Yeah. All right. So just to wrap this up, what's the one guitar in your shop right now that it's going to hurt you to say goodbye to?
Oh, geez. Beyond that advanced jumbo?
Yeah.
I mean, clearly the advanced jumbo. There's no question about that.
Well, which of the two advanced jumbos? Do you have your heart set on one over the other?
Well, one of them is really, really, really clean. Okay. So that one.
Okay.
The other one doesn't have strings on it right now, and the neck is not on the guitar, so I can't. It's not a fair A-B comparison, but I'm trying to get them both done, so that we can have two done AJs at the same time, because I think that would be really, well, that would make a cool little Instagram post more than anything.
Yes, it would.
That would be really neat. But, yeah, We just sold the guitar that I was most sad to sell. That was that super clean. We had a super clean 48 J45 that just came through. Yet another one. Last time we spoke, I talked about 48 J45s or post-war J45s and how hot they were lately. Well, we just had another one, and it sold before we even clicked update on our website. We had the whole thing listed, written about, photos taken, and then it sold in store, and then, you know, like 20 minutes later, the website got updated, and then we had to tell people who called that we didn't have it. But yeah, that one just went away, and I was bummed about that. I love a good J45. They make me very happy. So always looking for more of them. But that one was particularly nice.
All right, cool. Mark, as always, thanks for demystifying the world of luthery. You see things that I will never see when you look at a guitar, and one day we'll have to blindfold you and have you do like a guitar taste test thing, because I think you'd be spot on. You seem to know what you're
doing.
That
would be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we'll keep going. It'll evolve. It's all good.
For the next Fretboard Summit, if it ever happens, I guess.
For sure, for sure. Well, thanks for the call, Jason.
Of course.